of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Behind the curtain at most government agencies that deal with medical and scientific issues, hundreds of scientific advisory committees toil away in relative anonymity. This is the mundane stuff of government, where under blaring fluorescent lights in bland conference rooms, volunteers discuss Robert's Rules of Order, they pore over data and reports, research proposals, and statistics. But for all their lack of pizzazz, these scientific advisory committees play a vital role in government. They bridge the gap between the public, science, and the government, and they exert a tremendous amount of influence on government policy, on issues ranging from the use of human subjects in medical research, to new drug approvals, to work safety rules, to stem cell research. So how are the members of these scientific advisory committees chosen? Ideally, science and scientists would be neutral. But now critics charge that the Bush administration is staffing these panels with people picked for their ideology and not for their scientific expertise. People who believe in the Bush agenda on matters like birth control and stem cell research. People who represent industry and are not public advocates. Is this true? Can science be neutral? Can we separate science from politics? What do you think? Give us a call. Our number is 1-800-989-8255, 1-800-989-TALK. And as always, you can surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com for more links to our topics. Let me introduce my first guest. Dr. Anthony Robbins is a professor of public health at Tufts University in Boston. He served as the director of the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health under the Carter administration, and later as the chief health staff person for the Energy and Commerce Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. He joins us today by phone from Vermont. Thank you for being with us, Dr. Robbins. Dr. Robbins, are you there? Let's see if he's... We got him on the line.
Oh,
there he is. Thought we lost you up there. Frozen Vermont.
It is indeed.
Tell us about these committees. How many are there and how do they operate?
I'm not sure I know the exact number, but as you said, there are a large number. And they really bring democracy into otherwise bureaucratic agencies. They give an agency like the one I ran, the National Institute for Occupational Safety and Health, an opportunity to have a balanced group of experts debate issues. It's even more important sometimes than the specific advice that we used to get from the committee was the nature of the debate, the issues that were raised. It gave us an opportunity to go back and look at each of those very carefully. It also gave us a sense where scientists, experts, and to a large extent, therefore, the public was on these issues. They're a very important part of our democratic system.
Mm-hmm. And these people who serve, they're unpaid volunteers?
Well, actually, they get their expenses paid, and on some of the committees, I think they actually get a day's payment, because for some of these committees, and most of them, I think, these people become temporary federal employees in this role. One of the issues that's come up in the past is when they become federal employees, they have to disclose any conflicts of interest. And this is a difficult problem sometimes when you want advice on pharmaceuticals for the FDA, and you need to have people who work in the industry. Mm-hmm. And they clearly have a conflict. But if they're disclosed, it's part of democracy to understand where these people may be coming from and put that into the balance.
Mm-hmm. And they also save the taxpayer money, don't they, by having these committees?
I guess it saves money. You could run government without it, but I think that this is a pretty good safety valve to make sure we don't make mistakes, to hear all the sides on an issue before a decision is made. And in that sense, it's a great saving of wasted time.
Mm-hmm. Let me see if I can bring in another guest, see if he's on the line. Daniel Greenberg. Are you there, Dan?
Hi, Ira.
Hi.
Here I am.
Dan Greenberg is the Washington contributing editor for The Lancet. He is also the author of Science, Money, and Politics, Political Triumph and Ethical Erosion, published by the University of Chicago Press, and he's in our NPR studios. Dan, you have been an observer of the Washington science and politics scene, what, for 40 years, I would say?
Thereabouts, right.
Thereabouts. This idea of appointing of science and politics on committees, is it a new one? Have you watched it as long as you've been there?
Well, the advisory process is something that's been going on here for a long time. You could fill a large library with the reports that have been ignored, that have been produced by these committees. I think they do bring a level of expertise to government, but the question is who's listening to them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very easy to exaggerate their importance.
Mm-hmm. Anthony Robbins, you were the head of the National Institute of Occupational Safety and Health, so you have plenty of experience with these committees. Is there politics on appointing members to committees like this?
Well, there certainly has been politics. I recall, Dan, you'll certainly recall this, when the Reagan administration put a number of very political appointees onto the National Cancer Institute's National Cancer Advisory Board. And it wasn't that they were putting people who had a particular view of cancer or anything like that. What the folks at the Cancer Institute were upset about is they were putting people on the board who had been contributors to the Reagan campaign and had nothing else going for them as useful contributors to an advisory board on how the Cancer Institute ought to direct its research. There is one of the things that has happened with the recent Bush administration, and particularly in HHS interventions, though I see from a story in Science that maybe the Defense Department is having some of this as well, is that they have taken this down to the level of the NIH study section, NIH and NIOSH study sections, which have strictly been experts. These are the people who make evaluations as to the scientific merit of a particular research proposal. There's another level of decision-making beyond the study section in the council of these institutes, which sort of decide, after they know about the quality of the proposed research, they make an additional decision as to whether it fits in with the agenda of the institute and the contribution it will make to improving health in the nation. Those groups, the councils, have been somewhat more political in the past, but this has now gone to the point where, if we believe the stories we read, and this is what has the scientific community truly upset, that the Bush administration has been using political litmus tests on a variety of issues, including whether people voted for President Bush, to decide whether they should go on these strictly scientific panels, the so-called study sections.
Dan, would you concur with that?
Well, I would. I would like to amend that somewhat. There are very few purely scientific issues that come before the government or even its advisory panels. What we do have are political issues that have rather large scientific, important scientific components. It's very hard to develop a system in which you're going to isolate the science from the politics, because politicians feel they were elected to put their agenda across, and they want to appoint the guys who agree with them. And I think the Bush administration has been much more brazen and systematic about this than any of his predecessors. But this is not unprecedented. I'm going back to, you know, covering the days of the Kennedy administration. They put the people in there who agreed with them. And let's remember, you know, Richard Nixon was so unhappy with his scientific advisors that he fired them all, wiped out the White House Science Office and all its advisory committees. So this is part of the American political process. I think if scientists are unhappy about it, and many of them obviously are, they should get into politics. You know, they don't run for office in any significant numbers. Mm-hmm. They don't contribute money. They sit on the sidelines and say, listen to us. Mm-hmm. It doesn't work that way.
So do you think that this carping by the Democrats is just the expected political fallout of losing an election?
I think exactly. I think if the Democrats were in there, they might be doing something. Though, again, I wouldn't think it would be as systematic. This is a much more ideological administration than we've had in a long, long time. But going back to the early days of the Clinton administration, there was a senior executive at the Department of Energy who didn't agree with Al Gore on global warming and other matters that engaged the vice president's attention. and out he went far ahead of schedule.
Dan, I earlier made the distinction between people in the executive branch and the advisory groups, which I see as something of an extension of the body politic and citizens and experts brought in so that the people in an administration can get a sense and get advice that reflects the science and reflects where people are. Most of these are simply advisory, leaving the executive branch free to make the final decision, having taken the advice or having heard the advice. But what seems to be happening now, and what I find somewhat different, is the level of concern among scientists about being asked the kinds of questions that they didn't think were appropriate for picking scientific experts.
Such as?
Well, I'm judging only from stories I read in Science, mm-hmm. but people have been asked whether they voted for President Bush. People have been asked how they support the president's view on various genetic issues. This is not a good way to select advisors. These committees, in fact, the Federal Advisory Committee Act suggests that these be committees that are fairly balanced in terms of point of view represented and not inappropriately influenced by the appointing authority or by any special interest. When I ran NIOSH, we had a joint advisory committee, a rather more political one than the study sections. It was jointly advisory to the Occupational Safety and Health Administration in the Department of Labor and to our institute in the Department of Health and Human Services. But that group consisted of people from industry, people from labor, and people from the academic community. And I think our concern, as we suggested to our respective secretaries on these appointments, was that we got people who were articulate, who could clearly express their views, and would help create a good working committee that would be helpful to us. Now, clearly one of the things that happens in a new administration is that you bring in some people whom you may feel had not been heard in the past. But I think what's happening now goes well beyond that.
Well, I think there's a lot of dispute about the so-called litmus test. I mean, many scientists who have been appointed to committees in this administration say that no so-called litmus questions were asked of them, and that it was purely on the basis of their scientific, their professional credentials.
Dan, do you think that they were on record already on the things that would otherwise have been the litmus
test? Well, I think, in some cases they probably were, but, I mean, there are others who said that they were, you know, political innocents, and they, attention came to them because of their professional qualifications, and they were invited, and they joined up. But I think we have to recognize that this is an intensely ideological administration. It's extremely well-disciplined. In carrying its cause all the way down to the level of the advisory committees, the so-called fourth or fifth branch of government in some views, they are behaving in a very consistent fashion. It's not astonishing they're doing this. I think what is astonishing is the rather meek response of the scientific societies and the whole profession, the scientific community.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why they aren't up in arms about this. There's an occasional story in Science.
Well,
I thought we were trying to be.
Well, you're doing it today, so just hang on. We're going to take a break, and we'll come back and talk less more with Anthony Robbins, Daniel Greenberg, and also bring on a scientist who was on a committee and changed committees and then resigned the second committee. It's a very interesting story, so stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about how government science advisory committees are staffed with my guests, Anthony Robbins, professor of public health at Tufts University in Boston, Daniel Greenberg, Washington contributing editor for The Lancet and author of Science, Money, and Politics, Political Triumph and Ethical Erosion, And we're going to bring on another guest. But before we do, just a little reminder, well, a little notice to you. We're having trouble with our phones. So if you're not getting through, stay with us. We're trying to get the phones, our caller phones, working again. But sit back and enjoy the conversation while you can, because I'm going to bring on another gentleman who is Dr. Jonathan Marino. He is the author of Undue Risk, Secret State Experiments on Humans, published by Routledge. He's also the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville, Virginia, and a former member of the National Human Research Protections Advisory Committee. Welcome back to Science Friday, Dr. Marino.
Thank you, Ivan. Nice.
Why are you the former member? Tell us that story.
Well, the new advisory committee is the one of which I'm the former member, which mm-hmm. is now called the Secretary's Advisory Committee. I was listening in the conversation before, and I have to say, not only was there no litmus test of questions, in my case, there was not even the question, would you like to be a member of this new advisory committee on human research protections? And I believe the reason that there was such poor staff work in the case of this new advisory committee, that after the old one was shut down, is that there is very little interest in this administration in human research protections. But there's quite a bit of interest in the issues concerning the status of embryos.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Marino, let me back up for a second. Mm-hmm. Tell us about your first committee and your service on that, and why you refused to serve on the second committee.
Well, the first committee was appointed by the Clinton administration to help provide guidance to the federal government, particularly DHHS, on interpretation of the rules concerning human research protections. You know, this has been a very controversial area. Big research programs at universities have been shut down.
This is out of some deaths were occurring of Jesse Gelsinger, people like that?
Yeah, one of the issues was the Gelsinger death, and there were other incidents mm-hmm. involving normal, healthy volunteers in research as well, a couple of deaths.
Mm-hmm.
So this group of which I was a part, this advisory committee, worked, I think, quite a bit for a year and a half, and we produced a number of sets of reports and recommendations. Although we were told several times that either Secretary Thompson or...
Are you there? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm here.
Go ahead.
We were told that either Secretary Thompson or his assistant secretary were going to attend a meeting, and...
Mm-hmm.
That never happened. In one case, the assistant secretary was actually on the program and didn't show up. So we increasingly got the impression that the administration really didn't care too much about human research protections. When the advisory committee was up for to be renewed or rechartered in the middle of last year, we were told that we were indeed going to be rechartered, and then a couple of weeks later it turned out we weren't. The new charter for a new advisory committee included, for the first time, the population of human embryos as those who would be brought within the rubric of human research protections. Now,
they had never been in bailiwick of that committee.
That's correct. Children, mm-hmm. prisoners, pregnant women, but mm-hmm. not embryos per se. Now, mm-hmm. that struck me as odd because there's a very long history to this discussion. And embryos per se have never been part of the framework of human research protections. Perhaps they should be. Perhaps there should be an addition to the list of vulnerable populations. But there'd be no discussion of this.
Mm-hmm.
So it increasingly seemed to me that although the administration was not interested in human research protections per se, they were very interested in pursuing a particular political agenda. Furthermore, when the new advisory committee was established last week, there was no representation from research subject advocacy organizations, as had been the case on the former advisory committee. And since the trust of the potential population of the research subject is critical to testing new drugs and devices, it seems to me foolish not to have a member of an organization that represents that interest. Mm-hmm.
So the new committee not only had a bailiwick of human embryos, but it also missing from the new committee were advocates of the common person.
Right.
And so then you decided you could not be part of that committee.
Well, I had already written a couple of papers and had them published, one still on the web, in which I had reported my experience with the previous advisory committee, how ill-used we felt. And I thought it would be just hypocritical for me to accept appointment to this mm-hmm. new advisory committee. And if they had remembered to call me to ask me whether I wanted to be on it or not, I would have told them that, and it wouldn't have become a public issue.
Mm-hmm.
But I infer from all this that they really aren't interested in this set of issues. They're really interested in pursuing a certain agenda that I think ought to be part of the public discourse.
Mm-hmm. Dan, how do you react to that?
Didn't go on the committee. He certainly would be much more influential on these matters being inside than on the outside.
Well, Dan, you know, I've been on several committees, federal committees, and will continue to be. But the fact is that I'm able to be part of this conversation now and point out what's going on with this particular advisory committee precisely because I declined to be part of this process.
So you would have had to be quiet if being a committee member.
Well, that's right. If they'd gone through the usual process and called me and I'd said, gee, I really can't, instead of putting out a press release and saying I was a member, I wouldn't have had the platform that I now have, frankly.
We've heard Dan and both Anthony say that this is, especially Dan has been saying that, you know, this is politics as usual in Washington and that this happens every time that there's a change of administrations. What's wrong with that kind of response?
I didn't hear that much disagreement between them, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, Dan said, well, yes, it's going on. It's more brazen now. Dr. Ivan said, well, but it's reaching down to the advisory committee level. Who ever heard of these advisory committees? This is pretty arcane. And so I think that it's a difference of degree that is becoming now a difference of quality, that there is something different going on, and that there is an attempt to introduce themes and views into the framework of these advisory committees. That is not transparent, and that is a change.
Mm-hmm. Well, I would agree with that completely. I think this administration is going much farther than any of its predecessors in getting down to this level.
Dan, you said something earlier that you were surprised that scientists were not angrier and more upset about this. You're probably right. We were actually quite surprised when Science Magazine accepted our editorial complaining about this, and the effect that it's had is a number of our scientific colleagues have been in touch with us since it was published and said, how can we help? This is a trend which may not be the first time it happened. But it is certainly, as you say, gone farther than ever before. And what it is capable of doing is not just damaging the issue from the point of view of particular advocacy groups, but it may damage for the future the scientific usefulness of these advisory committees. It may make their advice no longer credible. And if we get to the point where administrations regularly ignore the advice of their advisory committees, that whole element of democracy disappears, because that was how an administration, usually sitting in Washington, learns what people think out in the scientific community about these issues and organizes advice that can be helpful.
Can I also add to that that at least one journalist this week has told me of her frustration in being told by scientists and scholars on these advisory committees that they sympathize with the position I've taken, that they've had similar experiences in their bodies, but she's frustrated that they will not talk on the record. And I don't really understand why that's the case, since most of us have tenure, and most of us have grant support that is vetted through techniques, through screens that are very hard for a political party to penetrate. I don't understand why more people aren't getting on their hind legs, if not resigning, at least making a statement.
Well, an editorial in Science is preaching to the faithful. I mean, who reads Science but
Agreed.
Scientists?
You're suggesting only the politically committed scientists read Science Magazine, or at least read the editorials?
Well,
it's a start.
We'll be unhappy to hear that. But
1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can take a phone call here on Science Friday. Hi, welcome to Science Friday. Joe in East Aurora, New York.
Hi, thank you very much for the show. Very interesting conversation. I'll have to agree with the gentleman that were saying that you have to separate political influence from science. Our main goal of science and the best things that have come from science are fostered from the ingenuity and correctness that the science brings. If you have a research grant that's going to be lost and you change your opinion to keep your research grant, then things like greenhouse gases and computer technology and, you know, alternate forms of fuel might be suppressed for the almighty dollar, whereas a scientist might say, hey, it's better to burn butter than oil.
Mm-hmm. Dan, any comment on that?
Well, I don't know exactly how to respond to that. No, I'll just pass on that one.
I wonder whether the caller is implying or saying that up to now the feeling out in the community, out in the across the country, is that these have been open and honest, non-political processes.
I think the public is probably very surprised to learn that so much of what goes on there is political. And they think that the government's there to take care of them, and the scientists do science, and that's what their job is, and, you know, that there's very little politics. I know of all the politics that goes over the years. I covered Washington, and they're always shocked when they hear about stuff like this. And, Dan,
well,
I'm sure you're not shocked by it anymore.
Well, look, there are about approximately 1,000 advisory committees spread across the whole federal establishment. I think there were 36,000 advisors at the last count. Most of these labor out of sight, and they're not involved with any ideological or political problems, mostly, you know, technical scientific stuff, things involving mm-hmm. health. When you get into certain areas, such as the regulation of polluting industries and anything involving reproductive biology, those are the minefields.
Well, let me ask this question. What happens if an issue comes up before the committee in which a member of the committee, maybe he belongs to a polluting company or a chemical company, he's absolutely in conflict of interest on that committee? What happens to that committee's ruling?
There are no restrictions on people having conflicts of interest on the committees. They have to state them. It's supposed to be transparent. The Federal Advisory Committee Act says the committee shall be balanced, but doesn't mm-hmm. define what's meant by balance. Mm-hmm. These committees generally do reflect the administration that they serve, and they serve the administration mostly in uncontroversial areas. It's these few areas of reproductive biology and pollution, environment, and so forth, that we're beginning to hear all these arguments about.
Mm-hmm. In my case, Jonathan Moreno, with respect to human research protections, that's a controversial area, but it's not necessarily a partisan controversial area, and it's being turned into one, it seems to me, by this process.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wonder, I might recall for you something that we did when I was working for the Principal Health Committee in the House of Representatives back around 1984-85. We had the experience with the appointments to the National Cancer Advisory Board, and were in the process of creating new legislation that would have established, and did establish eventually, a National Vaccine Advisory Committee to advise on policies around the development, research and development, and marketing of vaccines. What we chose to do with the Cancer Board experience in mind was to write into the legislation that the Secretary would appoint the members of the National Vaccine Advisory Committee in consultation with the Institute of Medicine of the National Academies of Sciences. And in that way, we thought we were insulating the committee from having blatantly political appointments. The qualifications would be vetted outside of the normal political process of any administration. And in fact, that system has worked very well for that committee, and it has been an effective way of dealing with many important and some of them quite controversial issues mm-hmm. in the vaccine area.
It appears if you search around in enough places, and there was one particular there was a web spot called sciencemag.org, and it has letters on it. Let me just remind everybody first that I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. On the website, there's a letter from a gentleman, William Howard of McLean, Virginia, who claims that he was up for a candidacy to be on the Army Science Board, and it went through all the levels into the White House liaison office and things like that, and it came back to him that he was denied the position on the board because his name turned out to be the same name of someone who contributed to Senator McCain's campaign, even though the middle initial was different. And he was denied because he had committed some dollars to the Senator McCain's campaign.
And he wonders
whether how pervasive this is. You know, this is in the military now. And
well, these guys are playing tough. I think we have to recognize that the Bush White House has taken this to a new level.
Hardball.
Yep.
But
he wonders whether it could be going on in places we'd never think it was going on. Do you think that might be happening?
Well, I think it would be very hard to find places it's not going on right now. I'm impressed as to how deep they have gone.
Yeah.
When NIH study sections start to be vetted against political criteria, that's clearly something I'm not aware has ever happened in the past. It's clear that people have added to study sections. These study sections are the committees that advise on the scientific merit of grant proposals. That as a field changes, they will say in appointing a committee, let's get someone from this new area that's developing rapidly. We need the expertise there in order to consider the proposals mm-hmm. that we're getting. But I think that's quite different than a decision that someone should be appointed because of some views on what are essentially political issues.
I wish we could have gotten some response from the government on this. We called the president's science advisor. And he refused to. His office refused to allow him to come on the program. And we called Health and Human Services, and they didn't even return our phone call. So,
I'd like to ask.
Go ahead, Dan.
The interventions in the study sections. We've had reports of that happening at NIH's Environmental Sciences Institute. Has it spread beyond that to the other institutes?
Dan, the only other one that I know of is NIOSH, which is, of course, not part of NIH itself. Yeah. It's a national research institute, but it's part of the Centers for Disease Control. But it does use NIH-organized and managed study section for its grant review. Grant reviews are conducted through the Division of Research Grants at NIH. So it's essentially the same kind of committee. And there was another letter in Science from Dana Loomis, would have been appointed to the NIOSH study section on occupational safety and health, and was not appointed
I'll keep coming back to the same point here, and that is that the scientific community has a real grievance. The process is being contaminated. We can see that the evidence accumulates. What's being done about it?
No, you mean the voices of scientists being heard.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to have some other voices heard in a few seconds here because we have to take a little break, so stay with us. We're going to come back and talk lots more about the issues, take your phone calls, and bring on another side of the story, someone who represents another side of the story, the Family Research Council. So stay with us. We'll be right back. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about government science advisory committees. Now, one Bush appointment in particular drew a firestorm of criticism. Dr. W. David Hager is an obstetrician and gynecologist from Kentucky who was asked to serve on the FDA's Reproductive Health Drugs Advisory Committee. According to several news reports, Dr. Hager has recommended that women suffering from premenstrual syndrome read the Bible. He also worked with the Christian Medical Association in petitioning the FDA to reject the abortion-inducing drug RU486. Hager was appointed to the committee, but not as its chairman. Planned Parenthood said Dr. Hager was just the latest appointment from this, quote, anti-woman administration, and called Dr. Hager, quote, a nightmare for women's health. But the Family Research Council says Dr. Hager is qualified for the job and has been the victim of so-called religious profiling. Joining me now to talk more about Dr. Hager's appointment is Pia Desilani. She is Fellow for Human Life Studies at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. Thanks for joining us.
It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me, Ira.
Why do you think he's a victim of religious profiling?
Well, because he's got credentials. He has fabulous credentials as a doctor, and these credentials have not been brought to light. He's published over 41 peer-reviewed articles in peer-reviewed journals. He's received numerous awards. He served on at least two government committees, and he has this track record, which is absolutely fabulous. And that's not being taken into account. I mean, and the reference, to recommending prayer for PMS. I mean, I think people should really go back to the sources. I've read that section in his book, and you know what he's his book is talking about the effect of stress on women and their body.
Mm-hmm.
And the first thing that he recommends for PMS is medical attention. The part that refers to prayer is actually from the person of his wife with whom he co-authored the book. I don't think it's any different than when I go to my yoga class and the yoga instructor talks to us about, you know, repeating our mantras to ourselves and dealing with our stress and so forth. It's really not that different, except for the fact that he's coming at it from a Christian perspective, and that's what he's being nailed for.
Well, some might say he's being appointed because of his Christian perspective.
Well, I think we could, but he's got credentials that justify his being appointed, whether he's a Christian or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me see if any of my panel wants to agree or disagree. Anybody want to?
Well, Jonathan Moreno, I don't know that it's this specific appointment that's the issue, although there's certainly a reason to be concerned about it, so much as the fact that it operates within a certain context, the context we've been talking about for the last 45 minutes. And that's what it seems to me is important here. And I don't think it's his religious views. It's his views. This is not an attack on Christianity. This is questioning whether his views, as expressed in a book on which his name appears, comport with what is known about science.
Well, in regards to this particular question on PMS, they do. I mean, everybody knows the first thing you go look for is medical attention.
Mm-hmm.
Then, secondly, deal with stress. Stress does affect women. There are different ways in which to deal with stress.
What about his views on the abortion pill RU486? He worked very hard to have it taken off the shelves, and yet he's now on the very committee that would be working, you know, toward okaying it. Is there no conflict of interest here?
I wouldn't. That committee would also be working towards reviewing the drug as well. And I think his concern is that the drug was not properly reviewed, which, I mean, the drug was fast-tracked. It was put on an FDA fast-track. Fast-tracking generally is reserved for, I mean, by definition, is reserved for drugs that deal with a life-threatening condition. Pregnancy is not a life-threatening condition in most cases, or it's not a life-threatening disease. And secondly,
Let her finish.
I'm sorry.
And it's also used for cases in which there's no alternative. Well, in the United States, abortion is surgical abortion is widely and readily available.
Okay, so you think that's the alternative, is just surgical abortion?
Well, the point is that the FDA fast-tracked RU486, and I think Dr. Hager's concerns with it wasn't properly reviewed.
All right.
As a member of this committee, you know, I think he can bring these questions to some weight to the question and say, look, let's properly review it. I mean, if we're going to put it out there, we're going to endorse it, let's make sure it's safe for women.
So if it turned out to be safe for women, then you'd have no problem with it?
I would still have a problem with it, yes, and Family Research Council would still have a problem with it. But I think that's
so. You're arguing from a false point of view that, you know, it's not safe. But even if it were safe, I find some other reason to argue against it.
No, I mean, we're just this is the most immediate way that we can address this question: is it safe for women?
Mm-hmm.
That's the most immediate way that we can address it.
Mm-hmm. Who wanted to jump in there? Was it you, Anthony?
I was simply going to point out that as I understood it, and my knowledge only comes from what I've read in the journals and in the press, the reason to move rapidly on the RU486 was that there was a very serious problems associated with surgical abortions, and that this was clearly a safer approach, and that's what if the committee decides it's a safer approach. Abortion being legal, they would approve it.
Pia DeSalani, I want to thank you for joining us this hour.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for taking time to talk with us.
Okay, bye-bye.
She's a fellow for Human Life Studies at the Family Research Council. That's an anti-abortion group in Washington, and she joined us by phone from there. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. Let's see if we can get a few phone calls in here before the hour is up. Let's go to Joe in Newburyport, Mass. Is that right, Joe?
That is correct, yeah. Actually, your last, the woman who was just on really made my point exactly. I was just going to call and comment that I think this administration has been pretty much hijacked by the religious right and corporate scientists. And she really made my point exactly in that they don't really seem to be interested in hard science. It's more they're trying to push a certain agenda on the population that's really counter to anything that's based on hard science.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just ridiculous what they've been able to achieve, and that really we're all suffering, and we're suffering as a democracy because of the views of this administration. You can't have... I understand people are religious, and I happen to be atheist. But really, science and religion have to be separate.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. Do you think that anybody can bring anybody, because they're a whole person, can enter into a committee and not bring some of their biases from any either their religious or non-religious views, things like that? Do you think if you served on the committee being an atheist, that would not get in the way of how you would judge something?
Of course you're going to bring your views to the committee, but you're going to have to look at the science first and put your views in the background. I mean, I would hope I would have the sense to judge the information on its merits, whatever, you know, the particular situation happens to be, other than, you know, putting first my religious views up front. Like, she just said, if the RU486 pill was proven to be safe, they're going to have problems with that on other grounds.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't, this is just crazy, the way this administration is being run.
All right, thanks for calling, Joe.
Thanks.
1-800-989-8255. Any reaction to the Jonathan?
No. I guess all I would is Dr. Robbins. Mm-hmm. I would say that we can't get in the business of screening in the other direction either, which is that the law calls for these committees being balanced. The addition of one member here or there with a view that may be based principally on his religious views and only secondarily on scientific views is not an intolerable situation. But what appears to be happening, and this was particularly clear with the advisory committee to the National Center for Environmental Health at CDC on lead, where lead being a very serious problem originally in gasoline and in paint, where levels have come down, and there is a continuing debate as to whether there is any safe level of lead exposure. It appears that three or four new members of that committee were selected explicitly for their views that lead is safe at much higher exposures than what the current scientific consensus would be. If the standard for lead exposure goes down, it will cost certain industries and certain landlords a fair bit of money to make housing safe, to make other chemicals safe. And it appears that the Bush administration is engaged in biasing the composition of an advisory committee for a particular political purpose.
This is Jonathan Moreno. I agree with Dr. Robbins that we have to have diversity in both directions. I think it's noteworthy that in the case of my advisory committee, the device was not necessarily loading it with people who had a certain view, so much as introducing into the framework of the advisory committee language that had never appeared before as a result of any public process. And in other words,
some of these committees have been reorganized and been given new jurisdictions by this administration.
I guess I would love Dan to come back and if he has a suggestion as to what we ought to do to get more scientists properly outraged and engaged, because he's exactly right. Scientists have always been loath to be political and get involved in these battles.
I'm gonna invite Dan to do that as soon as I remind everybody that I'm Ira Flatow and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. There, Dan, you've got the podium yourself.
I'm glad you asked. You've
been waiting for that question.
A large section of that book you referred to before, Science, Money, and Politics, deals with this question. And that is, we find every other profession, the teachers, the architects, the trial lawyers, you know, the physicians, you know, organizing politically, raising money to help their friends and punish their enemies, but not the scientific community. It stays aloof from politics. It insists that science is so important it should be insulated against politics. But that isn't the way the world works.
Dan, isn't it true
go ahead, Dan. Okay. I think Dan's just getting warmed up.
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
Ira, just getting warmed up. You're right.
Go ahead.
In the last election, the scientists were virtually absent in any organized entity. We, as I said, we don't find this with other professions. Now, what's the matter with our scientists? In the House of Representatives, we've got four PhD scientists, but they don't present themselves as scientists. They're busy with other things. There's no political mileage in science. They say it's a bipartisan issue. The scientific community, I think, has to recognize that science has become intensely political. The way the advisory committees come out on a particular issue has great political ramifications. And they can't just say that we're going to be antiseptic about this, we're going to tell you the truth. That old expression, we're going to speak truth to power. Power isn't interested in hearing the truth. Most science advisory bodies that are appointed by politicians exist for the purpose of providing them with material to support their preconceptions. That's what they're looking for. And you can get any answer you want by making up the body of the advisory committee. This is the way politics has worked ever since advisory committees came to Washington. And it's going to continue to work that way. And the scientists can wring their hands and say, you should listen to us. We know the truth. That's a waste of time.
Dan, I completely agree. I only make only one small amendment, which is to say that scientists have been very political in one area, and that is getting government money to pay for their work. They are well organized in that sense. And what is new is the sense in those very organizations, like the Association of American Medical Colleges and others, that they may need to get involved in the science itself to protect science from this kind of political manipulation.
All right, I'm going to have to break in here and just wrap it up because we have run out of time, gentlemen. Thank you all for joining me. Daniel Greenberg, Washington contributing editor to The Lancet, author of Science, Money, and Politics, Political Triumph, and Ethical Erosion. It is a great book, even though Dan Greenberg says it is. Earlier we spoke to Jonathan Moreno. He's here, the author of Undue Risk, Secret State Experiments on Humans. He's also the director of the Center for Biomedical Ethics at the University of Virginia in Charlottesville. And earlier we spoke with Pia DeSalani, fellow of Human Life Studies at Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. And also on this is Anthony Robbins, professor of public health at Tufts University in Boston. Thank you all for taking time to talk with us this afternoon. Our program is produced by Annette Heist and senior producer Karen Vergoth. Charles Berquist is our web producer, and our intern is Ronit Sokoloff. And if you missed any of the references we made today, surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where all the links that we talked about, so you don't have to keep the pencil going, just go over there at the end of the program. Also, we have Science Friday Kids Connection. We write, lessons and all kinds of stuff for your kids in school on the website, and all the teaching materials are there for your taking, so stop over and you can also check out past editions of Science Friday because they're all up there for you to download. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.